this is what we played at Xerox on the Star network, on the 6085s and the Star. And this sheet of paper sort of led to this fascination, this obsession that I had, because in my day job, I had run a company that does multi-user virtual spaces, 3D spaces. Not some micro games, but mostly for NASA, simulations for NASA. And I like, but in my night job in the barn, I'm in there tinkering with vintage computers. So this is like the perfect storm for me, because I was like, wait a minute, what he's saying, this is like the first multi-user avatar virtual world on the net. But there's, and I sort of Googled it, and there was nothing on the net, virtually nothing on the net. So I started a page, I scanned that in, that sheet of paper, put it on the net, and put a, you know, like, contact us if you know about this. And, you know, I started getting wonderful contact about this. And this whole fantastic history that was known by a private group, or maybe people who played Maze, when they see Maze or Maze War or Maze Wars or the Maze game, it had a lot of different names, and they see it, they say, oh yeah, I played that on a X when I was in college or something. So it Maze left this trail through history and through systems. It just was the meme that wouldn't stop. And then I found out that it started at Ames on the IMLAC PDS-1, and it had migrated across the nation to MIT. It had ended up at Park. It ended up written in Mesa on the Alto. Then ended up on Xerox Networks, on the Mac, on Next, on just about everything. And that it had even been used in a court case, a couple of court cases where someone had filed a patent on the idea of a network game system or a shared space. And Maze was the prior art, actually, that keeps us all from anybody owning that idea, because it is, you know, 30 years old, 30 plus years old, and it kept that idea in the open, the idea of a shared cyberspace, of a metaverse, basically. So I thought, well, Maze is pretty significant. And just like as we may think, you know, the Bush article from 1945, you know, when the web started getting popular, somebody dragged that out and said, look at this prior idea, as we may think. I thought, well, maybe for the game industry or for the multi-user industry, Maze, the story of Maze is the as we may think of, or as we may shoot. But here's another little quip for you. You know, they say that life evolved on Earth exactly when it could. You know, the ocean stopped boiling and there weren't any great big impactors coming in, and suddenly, boom, there was living things. You know, who knows where they came from. But it's almost the same thing here. Someone produced a networkable graphic workstation, and what happens within a very short time? A first-person shooter. So anyway, that was the idea waiting to come into existence. So the format of today's event is that I'm going to show some video. One of them, the videos that you see up here, is from a court case where they actually got two Alto computers together running Maze to illustrate how Maze worked for the court case. I took video yesterday of the exhibit upstairs, which has the IMLAC PDS-1 running the original Maze code, running it networked with a modern version of Maze on four other PCs, and then there's the Xerox workstations running Maze, thanks to Don Woodward. And I took some video of that so you can get an idea of how the game runs. And then Greg Thompson's going to come in, and he's prepared an excellent presentation on where did it come from, who worked on it, what are they doing now, you know, all this great stuff. And then after that, all of the panelists have their own Maze stories, and they're going to kind of go into those stories. And maybe Howard will tell us a little bit how he wrote the modern version of Maze. And it turns out probably half of you have written Maze because you had to as part of the course. And then you're welcome to put your own stories in. We're recording everything. The idea is to... I was up till 3 in the morning as I was so excited. I put all the video and the stuff from yesterday on the site, because the whole thing is that site is going to have so much stuff in it now, from audio and video and patents and pictures and stories and writing, that when they do write the history of massive multiplayer gaming or shared cyberspace in 20 or 30 years, Maze won't be a footnote, it will be a whole chapter. That was my goal. It will be a chapter. There will be original people there, accessible. It will become part of the understanding of the evolutionary tree. So with that, I'm just going to kind of run these and then get off the stage, because the real stars are here. Now, this is interesting. This particular video is
to be linked to other computers via a network called the Ethernet. Here you can see
the this was made about 10, 15 years ago, this video. It's not from the 70s. I wish I had two working Altos on this. I have one that can't be booted.
Here, the magnetic disc is loaded that contains the software for the games.
So these are lawyers making a technical video.
Each of the devices, of course,
or it's made for lawyers.
Here, we're booting up one of the devices, the one on the left, to play Maze War. Typing in Maze War Run, and we'll go into the program. You see it was created
the
22nd
the
of
date
November,
matters.
1979.
That's the second version of Maze, I think.
It would be earlier than
82. Going to type in
earlier than 82.
Suitable name. This guy is typing in Bomber. It's going to be the name of this particular player. This is the Duke host, as you can see.
Duke was always the host you connected to run Maze at Xerox.
This is a view of the maze at the location where Bomber happens to be looking. And down below, you see a two-dimensional plan view of the maze, the whole maze. And there's a little arrow. If you can look in the upper right-hand portion of the right-hand corner of the maze, there you can see it better. And you see the little arrow pointing, and that's Bomber traversing around the maze in a standalone mode where he's playing himself, just moving around in the maze. And, of course, if we could see upstairs to the three-dimensional view, you would be able to see him moving along the hallways. Now, we have two Alto computers connected together in this particular demonstration of the Ethernet, and now the second player is going to sign on and going to run the same program, Maze War, that's been loaded into the magnetic, by the magnetic cartridge into his machine, and he's going to select a name. And his name is Killer. So we have Killer on the right and Bomber on the left. And now Killer is in the game, and you can see that he, at the moment, sees himself there in the maze, and his view of the two-dimensional view of the maze, and he now knows that Bomber is also involved. Bomber now knows that Killer is involved. So both of them now are talking to each other. The computers know that they're there, and they're playing two players on two different computers playing the same game. And as you can see, the one on the right, Killer, is moving around the hallways while Bomber is standing still at this moment. So Killer's trying to find Bomber, and when he finds Bomber, he will be able to see Bomber's eyeball. And if Bomber happens to be looking the right direction, Bomber will be able to see Killer's eyeball. And sure enough, in Bomber's view, you can see Killer coming toward him now down the hallway while Killer is moving down the hallway, and now we're facing each other, and each sees the eyeball of the other. Now Killer turns around, Bomber turns around as well and can't see Killer anymore. Now they're looking at each other again. They can see each other. And see, when they turn and not looking at each at the other person, that eyeball disappears. And now Bomber is moving around the maze, trying to get away from Killer, perhaps. Killer's they shot each other. Looks like Bomber got hit. And he's moving now around the maze, trying to get away from Killer. Each time they get hit, they get put to a different part of the maze to start over again, and there's a score that's kept here. In this case, Bomber has -5, and Killer has 10. And they're now proceeding on, and somebody hit the other person, and now the score was tied up 5-5. You see two people playing here, both Bomber and Killer. When Bomber gets hit, his screen flashes. Now he's in a part of, he's moving away. Oops, he found, and he got hit again by Killer. And he's moving, Bomber's moving around. Oh, he found Killer again. Is Bomber going to be able to catch Killer this time? We'll see. Killer got hit. The flashing screen on Killer's side indicates that Bomber made a hit.
So even lawyers who actually got into this and got excited about it, but just a little bit of a side note. You see them on the Alto keyboard using the keyboard, which is the more popular use of Maze on the Alto was to use this key set, which of course Doug Engelbart came up with and Bill English at SRI, but you could really play quickly on this. There were engineers and people at Park that the key set was the device of choice to play Maze, and they were really fast with it. Of course, this has died and is in the dustbin of history, probably permanently as a device, but you could, of course, do two-handed operations with a mouse and a key set. But this is from an Alto. There's a couple of these in the visible storage, too. I'm just going to zip into some of the things that are going on upstairs. I want to point out that where's the other one? That we actually have a birthday cake, like we did last year, for... Okay, let's take a look at this. This is Tom Uban, who brought the PDS, the IMLAC, playing on the IMLAC version upstairs, which you can see, and you can go play yourself. And there he is playing the original IMLAC version. And there's Howard Palmer's IMLAC version circa 2004, playing on the same network via serial cable and an emulated PDP-10. With the IMLAC in the same space. So this is quite an incredible restoration.
Shoot anybody?
Yeah.
Show us the, there's someone. Okay, let's get him.
There he is. He's gonna shoot me.
I got shot by a robot.
Okay, good. Let's get shot.
Really? Let's get shot.
And I'm going to bring up Don Woodward here.
Okay, Don, state your name and what are you doing?
My name is Don Woodward, and we are playing Maze War on these nice Xerox 6085 professional workstations. These were mainly used as publishing workstations. The development environment, which I'm running now, the world-famous Xerox development environment, has Maze War, and that's what we're playing. We're on an XNS proprietary Xerox networking system, running on 10 megabit Ethernet, and we can have multiple games. We did have at Xerox multiple games on the corporate internet that span domains, so I could join a game in Tokyo, for example, if I was in Palo Alto. I wouldn't normally do that because of the latency involved, but
right.
Pretty much stick to my local network, but this is the game.
So we're moving through the maze.
So that gives you an idea that it's also upstairs. And just in advance, I want to thank everybody for pulling all this together for this anniversary. This has been phenomenal, and the amount of material that we've gathered for the virtual exhibit has been incredible. And in fact, the coup de grace was when Greg came this morning and he had done this just detailed, beautiful PowerPoint that is sort of like the document, I think, now for Maze, so that when somebody doing their doctoral dissertation writes that chapter or writes that book in 20 or 30 or 40 years, then it'll be a source material. So you just want to, of course, The team for getting it working on the IMLAC, that's incredible, shipping from Indiana, you know, in a custom-made crate and arriving in one piece is a fantastic achievement in getting it all networked in modern systems. So without further ado, I'm going to give the lavalier mic to Greg. Let's see. What's up? On already.
You can stand here. Still working? Great. Here. I'm Greg Thompson. I'm one of the various many authors in Maze War. I was actually there when the original idea. I wasn't the creator of the original idea. That was, as I'll talk about, Steve Pulley and Howard Palmer, who's also in the audience, will speak as well. But I'm the one that carried it to MIT, got it implemented there, and then from there a lot of people saw it and either implemented it directly or implemented the same idea in a lot of other implementations and versions.
You carried on paper tape, right?
I think it was a lot of paper tapes, yeah. I'll talk about it a little bit when we get in here. So let me step through it. The amazing thing, in fact, the subtitle to this is that it's a small world after all. Because, you know, as I started looking into Maze and the history, and I kept coming up into some of the same themes, it turns out a lot of the folks who are involved in Maze are into either video or supercomputers. And so I kept running into that, and so I'll make some of those references as we go through here. It actually started about 4,000 feet from here. At NASA Ames Research Center in the Computation Building, the Computer History Museum is kind of over here on the side. The map, the picture I had, didn't quite go far enough. This is the headquarters of NASA Ames. This is the Computation Building. This is the annex they built to hold the Iliac 4. You can actually parts of the Iliac 4 is in the museum downstairs, in fact. So we were mainly working in the Computation Building here. Jim Hart was the main administrator, main NASA employee that kind of sponsored this effort. It started as a number of high school students, myself, Steve Colley, and Howard. Now, Howard, I couldn't remember if you and Steve were from Limbrook or which school.
I was from Limbrook. He was from a different school.
Okay. We were from three different high schools. NASA had kind of a program set up with some local colleges and universities, but we were kind of exceptions that actually came in from high schools in a work-study program. I came from Homestead High School. I got involved actually through my electronics instructor there, John McCullum, which is another unsung name in the history, because John was a great guy. He had a lot of inroads to the industry. He had, integrated circuits when they first came out, transistors when they first came out. I remember building all sorts of stuff out of the same school and same lab as where Steve Jobs and Wozniak came out of, that went off and started Apple. I kind of went in a little different branch. I was involved in electronics explorer posts out of Hewlett-Packard. But then I got a computer connection for Homestead High School set up with an old teletype to the time-sharing system at NASA my junior year at high school. And that summer I started working as a high school student at NASA Ames for school credit. The summer I think I got employed by PMI, and which later Informatics bought. So it started as kind of high school for credit. It then moved into, getting a little bit of money to help Jim Hart in this computer graphics environment develop tools. Now, a lot of other people were there as well. Jim Clark worked in the lab. He was a postgraduate student at the time. He went off to found SGI and then Netscape, so he's famous here as well. In fact, I believe SGI built the building that we're now in. SGI was actually using the first cable video on demand trial, and actually I was involved in the first telco video on demand trial, we might mention a little bit later on. And SGI is now the major supercomputer supplier to NASA Ames, so a lot of different threads kept coming together. What was Jim's group really doing? They were trying to develop systems to help support the aeronautics research and the computational fluid dynamics research that was going on at NASA Ames at the time. They were in the process of designing the space shuttle. So we had, as you'll see in a moment, some IBM 2250 displays, which were relatively big and expensive, that were used to kind of display the results of the simulation, help the researchers figure out if their mathematical models, the computational fluid dynamic models were right. And so one thing Jim did was bring in some other types of displays, gears, including IMLAX, that could emulate IBM 2250s or Tektronix storage tubes to provide additional user interfaces to support this work. So at NASA Ames at the time, there was a CDC 6600, and then a 7600 arrived in 1975, then a Cray 1S arrived in 1981. The Iliac 4 officially started moving into NASA Ames in 72, and it was considered operational in 75. There was a duplex TSS 360 system that ran an operating system called TSS that Howard, I, and Steve got to know very well. That was kind of the main time-sharing system that we all connected to, and it was the main system supporting the wind tunnels. The one thing Jim did was started bringing in Digital Equipment Corporation systems, PDP-11s, VAX VMS systems that front-ended the data acquisition system for the wind tunnels. Also, as I mentioned, the Iliac 4 system was installed. A little bit of interesting history on it. Not all of it worked that great. As you'll see, the hardware is a lot of hardware to keep running One of the devices they had was really advanced at the time. It was a laser memory system that could store a terabit of memory. If I remember right, the unusual thing about that, it was really good at writing information on these Mylar strips. It was really terrible at reading, so it was kind of a write-only laser memory system. There were 40 packs of 10 Mylar strips. It took about less than 10 seconds to rotate the cartridge and grab a strip, and then about 400 milliseconds to get to the track. It was great, but the problem is the air filtration systems at the time weren't well enough to get the particle size down below the size that blocked the holes that it was burning. So a lot of interesting technology. Of course, now laser storage medium is kind of standard. Upstairs, where we were sitting, we had an IBM 1800, which is kind of an IBM 1130 with 360 channels. So we got all the hand-me-downs of disk drives from the 360. There's a 2311 disk drive you'll see downstairs. That was kind of our main storage that we attached to the IBM system. IBM, it ran a batch operating system called MPX from IBM. And then a number of us got together and wrote kind of a time-sharing system that ran in a foreground partition on top of that. We called GEM. And under that, we developed file systems, and we developed the infrastructure to support the IMLAC environment, being able to upload programs, download programs through serial interfaces to the IBM 1800. It supported all the IMLACs that were in the same building. It also supported IMLACs that were in other buildings around NASA Ames. Unfortunately, we hadn't learned about air detection, air correction protocols at the time. And so it was nice and reliable in the same building, but things tend to be problematic trying to support the IMLACs and other buildings like Bell Watson's and some of those other machines. The main display that we had on the 1800 was a 2250. Problem is it was bulky, expensive and stuff. So we brought in other systems. We had Evans and Sutherland's line drawing systems there. They're also still relatively expensive. So we had some Tektronix 4010 and 4014, but they're storage displays. So once you write it, the image stayed there until you manually flashed it and refreshed it. The most flexible systems were the IMLACs. And so IMLAC, NASA Ames had a number of the different IMLACs, including the PDS-1, the 1Ds, and the PDS-4. So these are some pictures that Steve forwarded us of actual IMLACs at NASA Ames. There's the one had logic in both sides here, and the programmer's console and the display. When they got to the 1D, they were able to re-engineer the logic to kind of only be in half the side. And they'd eventually moved to the PDS-4, and I'll have more information about that. The programmer's console changed a bit over time. You'll see different versions of it. There was available mice, keysets. You could put multiple displays on an IMLAC, potentially up to 4 displays. So we use that in a number of things. I mean, we used it to generate what you see is what you got text editing. There were programs to emulate the other graphics terminals, the 2250 and the Tektronix terminals that could be downloaded into the IMLAC. And of course, being high school students, not necessarily paid a lot, but having plenty of time, we also did various things to start exploring the technology. And one of the natural things that came up, of course, were games. So what is an IMLAC? The IMLAC Corporation was founded in 1968, around the same time that another computer graphics company called Evans & Sutherland was founded, around the University of Utah part of the country, if I remember right. In my research, I found there were 4 models I was aware of. Now, today I've learned that there was also another model after this, the PDS-2, that didn't make it see that much light of the day. But the main models we saw at the time were the PDS-1, and as I said, you can see the price there is about $8,300 plus a lot of options that you could add to it. It had 4,016-bit words of memory, had a cycle time of 2 microseconds, and a 15-inch screen. They then slowly improved it over time, a little bit faster, a little bit optimized, kind of a re-engineering in the 1D. The 1G came out just before the 4, because the 4, they were making the big improvement in performance, doubling the performance, a lot more options, standards, 17-inch screen, 16 levels of intensity, so it's not just on and off anymore, 4 virtual pages of graphics that it could have. Altogether, in Auerbach reports that I dug up indicated that as of 1977, they had sold over 600 units. So actually, there were a lot of different companies, especially around the ARPANET, that had them. So this is from the flyer on the PDS-4, which I have a number of things here. For example, here's the original flyer on the PDS-4. And actually, a lot of this I've scanned in. It's been uploaded to Bruce's site. And we're still scanning more stuff that I've collected and sent it up there as well. Now let's look at what it actually looks like from a hardware point of view. This is thanks to Tom's pictures he took of ISIMLAC, which is this the same one that's upstairs now? Okay. So this is it with kind of the covers off. You'll see most of the computer is built of a lot of these kind of plug-in cards. It reminds you a lot of DEC, you know, the original DEC designs of some of the PDP, early PDP systems. Big power supplies on one side and the other. The back plane is a lot of wire wrap. They put all of this together, and the monitor on the top. So how did Maze get started? It began with Steve Colley, I think, is credited with the original idea, looking at how to do better graphic interaction with the IMLEC. And so the first thing he kind of put together was a rotating wireframe, hidden line remove cube on the IMLEC. And this was in the time that I think I was working on an interactive debugger. I had a debugger that could get loaded in the IMLAC that actually interpreted the instructions, and you could set stop points, break points, and do debugging of IMLAC code at the time. Then I can't remember exactly, and Howard will have to fill in here, as to how the idea transitioned between him and Howard. But I know that I think Steve in his email said that he had the idea of putting people, turning it into a maze, using a 16 by 16 array. The idea is the absence of the dots in this array form corridors. And so in a very compact way, you could describe a maze. He then worked out how to display perspective view very time and cost efficiently. And if you're in a fixed point at each point in the maze, it actually was relatively straightforward given the bits around you, the rooms in the maze, which lines should be displayed and which ones should not, to give you a nice perspective maze. Then I believe Howard and Steve developed the first single-player maze and the ability to now move around and view the different parts of the maze. And I at that time, I think the game was just to try to find your way through the maze and potentially how to get out of the maze. And then there was a version, I think, still at Ames where we had a first multiplayer with a serial link between the two. And my memory is not good enough to figure out how between the three of us were that transition. Once you had that and you had multiple players, of course, the idea of giving them guns and shooting each other was added. So meanwhile, we all kind of went off to college. Steve went down to Caltech. Howard went off to Stanford. I went off to MIT. After my freshman year, I kind of learned what's going on at MIT. I found this organization called Project MAC, which later in 75 became Laboratory for Computer Science. Turns out they had a lot of MLACs as well. So when I came back for the second semester, I kind of volunteered, got involved there, and I brought with me a lot of the MLAC stuff that we had written at NASA Ames, including the maze game. So the debug program I was working on became the grade debugger at MIT. And Dave Lebling, who was working there, thought it would be a great idea if we can bring up Maze on the MIT system as well. So this is a picture of one of the MLACs at MIT, Dynamic Modeling System. There were a bunch of them used as terminals that had some improvements. It was actually communicating at 50 kilobits per second, which was an unknown speed at the time. So what I did is I significantly enhanced the code. I added some top-down views, make a full multiplayer game. I did the IMLAC side. Dave Lebling did the PDP-10 side, the emulator, which would download the maze game, allowed customization of the mazes you want to play in. It would send down what your user ID on the ITS system. ITS is the operating system they ran on their PDP-10. It stood for incompatible time-sharing system, as opposed to CTSS, which is the compatible time-sharing system at the time. It could have up to 8 players or robots, so the main monitor would generate robots instead of players. It include text messaging, so anything you type that wasn't kind of maze protocol would get echoed on everybody else's screen. And also there was a ability to give a top-down view to all the people kind of seeing what's going on the Evans and Sutherland system, so you could have a nice monitor there. And what we would do is you'd use the user ID, and in this version of it, you have two dots sitting on top of your name if he's looking at you, or you have an arrow if you're looking left or right, or if you didn't have anything on the top, it means you were looking away. So you had these names that would be appropriately scaled as it went further away down the hall. So the graphics wasn't fancy, but it was a true three-dimensional perspective. You're in this world moving around with other people playing the game. Now, J.C. Licklider, and there's a book written on him called The Dream Machine here, chronicles some of the work that he did at Project Mac and Laboratory of Computer Science, was the director. And one person that worked for him was Al Veza, who kind of ran the dynamic modeling group. And we're a little he was kind of concerned because, you know, DARPA money was used to fund the lab. So he tried to squash it and, in fact, had some people write programs to hunt down anybody that was playing Maze at the wrong time of the day, shoot it down. Of course, it was a wide open system, and so it was very hard to enforce that. And, of course, a number of times, as mentioned in some of the books, both of them were playing Maze as well. So the original Maze, this was the layout of it. In fact, I see it was the one that made it into the Xerox version as well. The original function keys are kind of described here. They used keys on the keyboard, but you could also use the keyset or the buttons on the mouse. I actually implemented some cheats into the game as well. Through a certain key sequence, you could take your MLAC and all of a sudden become somebody else. So you get the message of how they move, and it changed your view. So you all of a sudden became their eyeballs, for example. The other cheat that was neat is you could knock out or add blocks of the wall only in your copy of the maze and not on theirs. So you could, like, on theirs, it looks like you're walking out of a wall. Now, of course, you know, when you're really playing competitively, you're not supposed to use any of the cheats. But they were in the game.
How broadly known were the cheats?
I don't know. You know, I didn't broadcast much about them. I have to ask, you know, Ken is probably the best player.
We found out on the hard way.
Okay. Now, how did he do that, right? The original protocol is kind of described here. It was just text messages, you know, or binary bytes that were set over the serial line. A one followed by the ID of the player, since it indicates the player is leaving the game. A two followed by the ID of the player, the new direction he's facing, the new X and Y coordinate on the maze is the message that's sent out every time somebody moves. So it would send up to the PDP-10, and he'd echo the message down to all the other players in that particular game. Corresponding message for somebody dying, also for announcing a new player, you'd send six characters of the name. Also, if you noticed in playing the IMLAC version, the names are listed down the sides. And there's actually both the scores of the number of times you hit somebody and the number of times somebody hit you is listed as well. So the monitor program is echoing that information around, you know, as you join the game, or telling how many, you know, what the current score is, how many times you were hit and how many times you hit somebody else. Anything else was just basically text that was echoed on everybody else's screen. So you could intercommunicate. This is one of the first instant messaging systems, you know, which is now very prevalent in a lot of other environments. And not all of the IMLACs were playing Maze. Some of them were playing music and other purposes, at dynamic modeling as well. So we had it working with at MIT. Well, it turns out IMLACs are actually very popular and prevalent in the early ARPANET. If you go back to some of the early RFCs, those are the numbers, you know, in the first 1,000 of them that actually refer to IMLACs. And different people talking about, you know, getting together with a user group and writing code and making up protocols that can, you know, remotely do graphics over the ARPANET. And so it was actually in use at a number of different sites, including the ones I list there on the side. Well, what this naturally led to Maze going beyond MIT and, you know, being used across the ARPANET itself. Now, there's a legend, and we have no particular way to verify it, but the legend was that at one point during this time frame, MazeWorld was banned by DARPA, because they said that half the packets in a given month were actually MazeWorld packets flying between Stanford and MIT. I don't know if that was actually true. Clearly, there were a number of sites, including the UCSB, that played it as well. But it was a rumor. Also, as I did some research, I found some testimony or something somewhere that it came up in a debate about whether or not they should allow U.S. senators to have computers in Congress, because they were afraid that they might, you know, be in a network and spend their time doing Maze War or something. So there was a lot of interesting lore that Maze has made through the history. Now, one problem is the original version of Maze wasn't really designed assuming the long, you know, high latency and overhead of the ARPANET. So the main thing you're doing is moving, and those generated relatively long messages. So to make it more efficient, Ken here and Charles actually redesigned the protocol a bit to, instead of sending absolute movements, sending relative movements and crunching it back down into, you know, one byte messages effectively. So that was one of the important optimizations. Well, so that was the first kind of software implementation of Maze. It turned out a number of us at MIT at the time were undergraduate students. One of the courses in electrical engineering department you had to take was Digital Design Lab. So there were three of us that had the idea of doing a hardware implementation of Maze. And this was the original report. Enthusiastic. No, you know, they told us it couldn't be done, but we thought we'd do it anyway. We actually implemented full three-dimensional perspective. So we didn't just have one floor, we had four floors. And we had shafts and elevators you could go up. And we had the different players display the different characters with multiple Maze. And this is all done in 7400 series logic. You know, so this is a pure hardware version of the game. I actually designed this. I designed the custom Maze processor. So that's from my report in here of the actual architecture for the game. George Waldman wrote the software for it. It was in 256 16-bit words. They were using a pair of 1702 PROMs. There were 128 bytes to store the actual Maze itself, which was now a 16 by 16 by 4 array, and 128 bytes for state. And Mark Horowitz, we were all at McGregor House at MIT, he designed a display processor. And for the output devices, we actually used Tektronix oscilloscopes with, you know, Z-axis modulation. So we moved the beam around like you would on an IMLAC and turned it on and off, and had you could have up to eight players. Of any four of them could be human. And then this hardware game, the hardware machine would actually generate the other robots. Now, if the robots were too good, you slow down the clock rate. So, if you're not strong enough, you crank up the clock rate. Because that changed how fast the robots ran. It didn't change how fast the human people ran. It's a little hard to see here, but this is the architecture of the instruction set. You know, that it was really optimized for doing functions within Maze. As I said, George Waltman wrote the software for it. So here's the kind of pseudo language translated into the microcode that's loaded into the PROMs. At some point, I will finish loading all the rest of this report up on the website. As I'll say later on, it's always been a desire of me at some point to re-implement this, because it actually took six rails of logic. This is a picture of it that appeared in Scientific American, September 1977. There was an article microcomputers about Humeng Tum's lab. But what happened was this game was so popular that even though it was for a digital design course and they had these kind of cards that are used by each course year after year, they didn't want to take it apart. So it stayed around, built up in these six rails of logic. It's all the wire wrapping, you know, the push pins you see on the back for, I'm not sure how long, you know, at least a year or so, because it appeared in September 77 here. There was 83 cards. Each card had a couple chips on it, basically, that were the four rails for the main processor, two rails for the display processor. You loaded the layout of the Maze from the paper tape reader. And as I said, the clock rate controlled how fast they played. Now, that's the hardware version. Around the same time, as we'll hear more about, is it made it to other platforms. So Xerox Star and Altos platforms, so I think the main developer there was Jim Guyton.
Guyton.
It was reportedly based on the MIT IMLAC version. Now, the main difference here is it's a raster-oriented display. So really, you know, I think the code was probably rewritten pretty much, but just following the same architecture protocol look and feel, with significant improvements because you've got a raster display. So we no longer just had, you know, little textual names or graphical figures. We now had eyeballs. And I think the first version I read ran over the 3 megabits per second Ethernet. It appeared in other forms. There's a version called Snipes for DOS written in 1982. It was developed by Drew Major and Kyle Powell in Provo, Utah, who went on to found Novell. So this was, it was actually used to test the new, brand new IBM PC they got in LAN networking as a demo for the Superset software that led on to Novell, and they ended up bundling it as part of the Novell networking. So it was two-dimensional graphics primarily, but the same idea, but it was widely distributed, and anybody that had a Novell network at the time probably had a version of Maze Wars in this form of Snipes running on their system. It made it over to the Macintosh in a couple different implementations. This is one by MacroMind. I never saw this one myself, but the next version,
MacroMind became MacroMedia.
That's correct.
That's when they were still in Chicago.
The next version was the Super Maze War, which we actually had running at the DigiBarn.
Yeah.
And if we had more time, we probably could have got it here as well. But it now was a full three-dimensional color version of Maze. And actually, Apple bundled this in to the sale of a Macintosh for a while. So it made it further out into the world. There were many other versions, X Maze Wars, the MIDI Maze that used the MIDI interfaces for the Ataris. There was one version for the Game Boy, a version for Next Step. For Palm OS, the original video entertainment system, those cartridges, the home game system, had a version of Maze. Unfortunately, I didn't put it up there because I couldn't re-verify my link of information on the story, the version of it.
Sun employees told me in France at Sun.
A lot of different versions. I mean, it's made its way, either just the idea or sometimes kind of porting the code across. Now, there's another major event we have some other people who can talk about is in 1992, Ken, Jack Haverty, and a bunch of other folks implemented Oracle Maze for the interop demonstration in 1992, showing off SQLNet and how you could use this networking-oriented system to provide a common middleware environment on a lot of different platforms. And the application they brought up was Maze. So this is from the little flyers that were handed out at the time. It talked about, what is Maze, giving the idea how to play Maze, what the rules were. Basically the same rules as the original Maze game, but even much better graphics on a lot more platforms. It was really great. And finally, people implementing it. So who actually had Maze up and running in their booths? We're all across the exhibition floor. So that was the last big deployment of Maze that I'm familiar of. Now, then we come to year 2000. I got this email from Charles Frankston at Microsoft indicating there was a patent attorney trying to track down more about the roots of Maze. There's been a number of patent cases of folks that feel they had the patent on this multiplayer network game arena, and they were trying to track down prior art. So this is the one that I got involved with, the Citrix versus Electronic Arts. After we dug up all this information, and at the time we couldn't actually find a working IMLAC, so we'll see. I'll show you a VCR tape in a few minutes. We actually created a full three-dimensional simulation of the game. They settled out of court. So, there's not a lot of details. It didn't actually then help prove that Maze was the first multiplayer game. But, after all that research, it kind of is apparently the case. Maze is now kind of appearing as just standard class assignments. If you take this computer science course at Stanford, I was noticing on the web a couple nights ago, their first assignment is to create a Maze War. Now, this is a software version of it, and they give you a lot of the infrastructure, to start with. But the University of Pennsylvania had the same idea. And as I mentioned, a wish of mine at some point is to take the hardware version of Maze, which has, all the schematics in here for the game, as TTL logic, and re-implement it in a single chip. With today's technology of FPGAs, you could probably easily do it in an Altera or a Xilinx part. And so between my job at NCUBE, where I ended up becoming the CTO, to my current job, where I'm now Chief Video Architect over at Cisco Systems, I had a month or so, and I started putting together the infrastructure to do that. Unfortunately, I didn't come up to speed fast enough on doing FPGA designs to do it, but that's something I'd always like to do someday.
I started to upload
this report. There's between it and the corresponding book, which had the details of the different boards, there's about 150 pages. And I just got the first, 10 pages or so. So that's high on my list to finish scanning this stuff in to make it available to anybody who wants to try to implement it.
If you want to, if you just put MazeWar into Google, our page comes up first, so easy to find.
And if anybody's interested, you know, come by me and get a card and contact. I'll be happy to help you. I think it'd be a neat idea. So what did people do after Maze? Steve Colley, who I think had kind of the original idea, went on to found Encube, a supercomputer company, which it turned out Howard and then myself also went to work for. So Larry Ellison bought the company in the late 80s, and we kind of moved from scientific computing to a parallel system for Oracle database. And then in the early 90s, he was approached by British Telecom, Bell, Anik, Telecom Italia to do early video on demand. So while they were using SGI hardware for the first video on demand on a cable company in Orlando, Florida, we were involved in doing the first video on demand for telco companies. That's now come around. At this point, there are three major companies in the video on demand space: C-Change, which is the technology that's just not, Comcast is now deploying in the Bay Area. Concurrent and Encube are the dominant players. But now the telcos have realized that they need to get into the video space as well, because the cable companies are now going to be providing voice. So anyway, Steve's holding up one of these boards. At some point, I'm going to try to get this down into the museum downstairs. But this is one of the array boards from the Encube 2 supercomputer system. This is 64 processors, the six-dimension hypercube. 16 of these cards get plugged into that chassis with a 1,024 processor system. So it was an amazing amount of processor performance that was possible at the time. Originally designed for scientific computing as a business supercomputer, but then actually the very first supercomputer used for video on demand. So there were these installed in Reston, Virginia, delivering video. We were doing MPEG-1 video and MPEG-2 transport stream. These were also British Telecom in their environment. And meanwhile, you know, that evolved into later technologies, and now there's a whole host of other vendors getting into that space. Dave Lebling, interesting history of him. He did the PDB 10 side at MIT. Well, that's also where the game Dungeon, if you ever heard about it, came from. And so he went on to form Infocom, where you had all these interactive fiction type games like Zork, Enchanter, Suspect. I always like interactive fiction games because it requires your imagination, you know, to kind of fill in where you are. Now, with the fancy graphics we have, they're not as hot because you actually can do the visualization of that as well. But I think it was a great area. So, you know, Dave went in that direction. Mark Horowitz, who did the display processor of the hardware version, is now a professor at Stanford University. He's Yahoo's founder professor there. And he was one of the co-founders of Ramba. So I was hoping he would pick up the idea of doing the hardware version as a hardware project, just like they're in the software side. They're doing the software versions of it for the computer science side. George Waltman, who did the firmware for the hardware, is actually the person that wrote the great Internet Magazine Prime Search code. It's used throughout the world to find the next largest prime number. So these are the current top eight prime numbers that are known. And that's what the number is, how many digits are in that prime number, the type of prime it is. And I can't pronounce it right. Primes are of the form 2 to the n minus 1 are these Mersenne primes. And then here's who discovered it. So you'll see George's name on the top because he wrote the code that's used to actually find this. It's the first kind of grid application that's designed to run on everybody's PCs, you know, as you download it and searching, you know, that's shared working on this problem. So that comes to the end of my presentation. So when I say happy birthday, MazeWars, it's been 30 years since we kind of took it over to MIT, turned it into a multiplayer game, and so we're all ready for the next generation. So this was a shot from yesterday that I thought was very applicable. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. That was wonderful. What we're going to do now is pass the mic on, and any of our participants who are in the audience, feel free to
come up here and join
and join us.
And you probably got to do a quick introduction of folks.
Why don't you do the introduction?
Howard was a cohort with me at NASA Ames, was one of the authors before me, really, of the Maze game with Steve Colley. Tom, his IMLAC we have up here, he also works for Cisco, it finds out, and has been very much involved in getting the more recent version working with Howard. Ken was at MIT as well at the time and was probably the very best maze player ever known. You couldn't beat Ken very much at all. He was also involved in the resurrection of the maze at Oracle. And I apologize, I forgot.
I'm Jerry Morrison. I was also MIT. I was probably the worst maze player. as well as Xerox, and I saw the report go there. So I can't take any credit for implementation, but I can tell you some stories about it.
So who wants to tell some stories about it?
Who wants to share some information about it?
All right, I'll start the story.
Okay. We can hold this and so we can get it on the video.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm curious, first of all, how many people here have used a time sharing system before? Okay. So for those of you who haven't, an interesting thing to know about time sharing systems is they run faster at night. And if that doesn't make sense, it's because there are many fewer people running on them at the same time, and you're contending with fewer people. So there were two reasons that we played maze at night. One of them was the machine was you know, freer, available, the MLACs were available, and the PWB10 was less busy. And the other is, as Greg mentioned, Al Vezin was worried that ARPA execs would log in the middle of the night or sometime in the daytime and see all these people playing maze and take away the machine. And that might have been a well-founded fear, I don't know, but the result was that we played at night, and if anybody did log in, they would see a lot of people logged in doing something. They wouldn't be able to tell what we were doing, because we were all, you know, using some different names or whatever for the program, but that's what they would see. Particular night, one thing I mentioned about the MLAC now. The MLAC had, as Greg mentioned, a vector display, and you could create a static picture, pretty much static picture of vectors and use that as your logout picture. So when you left the computer and it was available for somebody else, you'd leave a login picture there, logout picture. And I created a picture of the maze, the lines and everything from the hallway view. And then one night, I refined that picture a little bit, made it perfect. I mean, it had Al Vez's initials in there, the eyeballs staring you down, and a little score and all that kind of stuff, just ready to push the fire button or whatever you wanted to. And then later that night I played maze and got completely trounced and decided that, you know what, programming was more fun than playing maze. Mm-hmm. And I left my logout picture there and went back to programming, and Al Vezza comes in the morning, and boy was he furious, because there was a picture AV in the maze, and he wanted to know who was logged in as him playing maze. I had a hard time convincing him that it was really my logout picture. It was just new. And let me contrast this with the Alto implementation for a second. Since the Alto has non-vector has a bitmap display, and it wasn't really fast processor. So it could draw those lines, but as you made your turns, it would take it a while to build the whole scene up. Okay, so they used a clever technique that they showed the most closed in parts of the lines first, and then the rest would fill in if you didn't move by that time. Okay. Result of both these versions of it, I noticed that I was always disoriented in the maze. You know, you push some button and you turn some multiple of 90 degrees and maybe hit the button you thought you hit, or maybe I hit the wrong button. And you'd be looking at another view, and maybe it was another direction, or maybe it was the same direction, or maybe it was another view. Anyway. One thing that later evolved was, obviously versions that could dynamically show you the sweep of the motion. But one thing that was done also was really cool was on the Atari 800, somebody hooked up the paddle controller. So this is a little rotating controller. So now if you just hold it like this and rotate 90 degrees, you would be looking 90 degrees. Rotate back 90 degrees, you'd be looking this way. And there, it was just really conceptually memorable. Was easy to track on what you're doing. Anyway, who wants to talk next?
Talk about getting it back up and running, maybe? Howard or Tom?
Yes, do that.
As I mentioned, when I got involved in the patent case, we couldn't find a working MLAC. I hadn't found Tom yet at the time.
So actually, maybe I should quickly show the tape. So we end up having to do here.
Let's see. How do you switch to the video? Can you? There it is. Video. I'm going to bring this guy up. Why don't you go ahead and talk about it? I'll see if I can get it working here again.
Okay. This project actually started out, as Bruce said, several years ago when he first started putting stuff up on his site. And I came across that one day and sent in my recollections of how things went back then. And about that time, I also started doing searches to see what else I could find out on the internet, and came across an old discussion list. It was like an MIT alumni discussion list, and they were actually talking about the origins of maze there, like, you know, didn't it start at MIT and so on. And I don't remember who now, but somebody on that list posted the source for the MIT maze war for the MLAC, and from that I was able to capture that source and save it. At the time, I didn't do much more with it other than look at it and say, wow, that's old.
Yeah.
But that was actually what allowed us to recreate it on Tom's MLAC. I had to first write an assembler for it, and I just wrote the assembler in Java, which was sort of a weird experience because back in the Ames days, I wrote several assemblers, cross assemblers for the MLAC for different machines. I wrote one for an SEL 840 and a couple on the IBM 360, and writing it in Java was kind of an eye-opening experience to see just how much things have changed.
For the better or worse?
For the better, I would say. It was a lot easier, and I think in some ways a lot more fun to write it. I mean, I was using regular expressions in Java, whereas back in the 360 version, I was figuring out these translate and test tables to figure out, you know, what byte was next in the syntax and all of that. So regular expressions is a vast improvement over that as far as how long it takes to do it.
Greg,
you got the...
Now. So this is actually a 3D simulation that was done of a PV10. This doesn't exist in reality, but we had to kind of demonstrate what maze looked like for the court. So we have, you know, an emulation of a PDB-10, kind of the MLACs, different pictures and stuff that we had dug up, and trying to show what it looked like. And it looks like it's a little hard to see it. There's the top-down view of the game.
And are you actually emulating the maze war code in the emulator?
No, not directly. Through my descriptions with different folks who were putting this together, and Salam was actually involved in helping putting this together as well. Describing what it looked like, but I did look through the code as I'm, you know, figuring out how it actually behaved and what it should look like on the screen. So the idea was to kind of, you know, give the court, you know, the idea of what it looked like when you're playing maze. Actually did a pretty good job, I think. So it's actually pretty short. I think that was probably it. The real thing is even a lot better. So when we get done here, I'm going to go upstairs and see it on the real machine.
So anybody else?
I can continue with the restoration. So once we had an assembler, Tom had already a mechanism on his MLAC for downloading programs over a serial line from a PC. So we assembled it, the MIT source, and downloaded it. And at first, it didn't work very well. What we found out was that there was a modification that was done to the MLAC at MIT to increase the addressability of the display list instructions. So in the original MLAC, they could only address, a 4K bank
For display
of MLAC memory, and these were running on 8K MLACs. So they had this mod that would let them use an extra bit in the instruction to address the full 8K. And Tom's MLAC didn't have that, so I had to kind of take the MIT maze war source and move things around a little bit in order to get the display lists all within the same
Now I should point out, they're debugging this on different parts of the country. You know,
right.
So Howard's here in California, and Tom, where are you based?
In Indiana.
Indiana, you know, doing all of this.
In Chicago.
Yeah, so he's kind of telling me what he sees when he brings it up.
Were you guys running it over the modern internet between the MLAC and
not
the
not at that time.
Not at that time.
When we were first bringing it up, it was just sort of Tom downloading it to the MLAC and telling me what he saw, and then I would go back to the MIT source that I had, and I go, you know, what is it doing? I mean, the thing was that I had never actually seen the MIT version played.
Right.
I used the one at Ames, which apparently has been lost to history, I guess. No one seems to have a listing of it anymore.
Steve in his email said, unfortunately, he finally cleaned out his attic, and
yeah.
He had tossed out a couple versions of it.
So I had never seen the MIT version, so I didn't really know exactly what it was supposed to look like. So when Tom is telling me, you know, he sees this or he sees that, then I have to go away and read the code to try to figure out if that was right or not.
Yeah, that was one of the great revelations when we switched from using email to converse because he was making more progress in a faster pace. We switched to Yahoo Messenger, and I'm sitting here watching the display, and I see my representation on the screen blow up in this little spinning, like a twiddle on a Sun workstation when it's downloading, only it's bigger. And Howard's saying, well, what does that look like? He's never seen one. Howard's developing code that was written at MIT off of code that he worked on at Stanford and NASA Ames, and I'm describing what it looks like. It was very strange.
It was very strange.
So let's see. We, I guess, eventually got the MIT sort of working on the maze. We had to get, before the MIT maze board would actually come up on the MLAC, it was waiting for the protocol from the maze server. So I wrote another little program in Java that would talk over the serial line and send it the message that it was expecting from the main server.
First you sent me a little binary of the message, and I incorporated that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I just sent him the message, first of all. He just blasted it over the serial port, and the display came
out. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So
now, what do you have as the master? What do you have to emulate the PDP-10 code?
Well, now we actually have the PDP-10
code.
Right upstairs. It's Ken's code running on it.
So I wrote a server that written in Java that would talk to the MLAC, and I also wrote sort of a clone of the maze board in C to run on the PC, and so we could play between the clone and the MLAC, and Tom and I played a few games sort of doing that.
Little test games.
Yeah, just to verify that it was working. And I'll let Ken describe the PDP-10 thing, because that's actually fairly amazing too.
I'm very happy that you found the actual source code for the MLAC, because, well, this is what I used. This is an actual listing. You won't recognize the name. It used to be called Maze. At MIT, we always used a different name so that it couldn't be found and deleted.
Half
of this PDP-10 code actually is scanned in OCRD and then back. And it took many hours of fixing the flaws in the process. And then we already had a PDP-10 emulator that I wrote some years ago running ITS. So that was the easy part. We brought up ITS, and then we tried to debug that maze code again, and it was a very weird feeling. Then we had to modify a little bit to talk directly to the network. That would require that we would log in. So it came up as a server now. And then at night or two, talking with Howard to get that working, and we found some more bugs and fixed them. That was a lot of fun.
Now, Ken, you were involved in the Oracle resurrection as well, right?
Yes.
You want to mention some things about it?
Jack Haverty, who, as you said, used to be at MIT. Apparently, he was the one who came up with the idea of using Maze to demonstrate how fast SQLNet really was.
He's even going over different kinds of networks. He didn't just respond to one network, but translated from one to another. And translated from TCP/IP. It's hard to remember now, but back then, many different kinds of networks, TCP/IP was not yet winning. So anyway, I haven't seen that paper for a long time. I'm happy to see that you saved it.
Yeah, it says that over SPX, IPX, TCP/IP, the OSI stack, DECnet, Vines, Novell. So
right.
Back in the days when we hadn't nailed down into one choice for networking.
Right. So a small group of us, which ended up being myself, Mark Lambert, who actually lives near here but is not here right now, did most of the coding. We started with an X maze war and just modified it, replaced all of the network calls, replaced all of the graphics with calls to Oracle's own UI. We added many features that marketing wanted to have involved in it so that the game would seem more like more accessible and easier to understand. We wanted people to play it instead of just looking at it. For example, originally we had a 2-second timeout. And we reduced that to 1 second. That was probably the most difficult for people to understand. They would shoot and nothing would happen. I mean, you could shoot and go away and your shot is still there, and then it would explode. That really confused people. So we kept that, but we reduced the timeout. Tried to explain that it was a magic slingshot. And that's how they sold the game.
Yeah. I had a hard time figuring out what this magic slingshot was in this presentation. Yeah, I also see they had it over IBM SNA as well.
I'll throw in one more funny thing. Before we knew that Tom would actually bring the MLAC, I thought that Howard would have a client working. We considered trying to port the Oracle maze back to, bring it back to life, meaning replace the network core, replace the toolkit. I didn't have enough time, but there's another guy that I work with, Ed Falk, who's sitting right over there. Actually succeeded last night, apparently. Not soon enough to demonstrate, but now that's become fully portable. Expect that you'll see it real soon.
Great. Just are we going to make a GPL version available of a GNU version of the the client?
Or? I expect so. Yeah. Maybe that's my plan. I need to clean it up a bit. There.
Yeah, this is kind of a neat full circle thing.
The client that I wrote for Windows was intended to look as much as possible like the one that runs on the MLAC. So I resisted the temptation to make improvements and things. But it is still missing some things that I consider sort of essential to the look and feel of the MLAC version, one of which is explosions. And a lot of that was because I couldn't figure out from reading the code exactly what the explosions would look like. And it's kind of hard to duplicate the vectors and the rasters and such. So I'll probably make some sort of an attempt to do explosions in the version that I have and do a little bit of cleanup. But after that, my plan is to release it under GPL. And I expect we'll probably have an announcement on Bruce's site when it's available.
You may want to take a look at Salam's PDP-1 Space War because on the CRT that he's got, he's made an intense effort with the pixel brightness and whatnot to emulate the phosphor on the game to make it look like what it was. So there's some tricks done. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm gonna add in a couple more things. First, the explosions. Actually, they're accurate. I'm very happy when I saw that and said, yes, that's exactly how it looked. I never thought that I would see it again. And one more thing. One thing you need to add to your client that's not there now is what we called the talk buffer. You might not realize it, but that was one of the most important parts of the game for me. You remember, I can't talk to people. I can't yell at them, but I could type to them. And for me, that became a large part of the fun. And you know that you could use it as a tactic, because if there are only two people, how do you meet each other? You tell each other where you are, okay, and then you can have a face-off in that long hallway. Or you can say that you need to do the face-off, and then you wait for them to go past on the way, and you can get behind them. I mean, that made it a lot of fun.
These are wonderful stories. Any other... from the panel or the audience.
I can tell the story of the real life maze that we had at Ames. I don't know if Greg remembers.
A real life.
But he probably will when I describe it.
Probably.
The way the building at Ames was set up was there were offices all around the outside where the windows were, and the middle part was sort of the computer rooms and things like that. And the room that we were in the second floor of that building. The computer, the 1800 that the MLECs were connected to, ran off of card decks mostly. So there was actually a lot of rubber bands around at the time.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm remembering. Go ahead.
So there was at least one night where we got into sort of a full-scale rubber band fight and sort of running around the corridors of this building. And you know, the corridors would extend the full length of the building and go all the way around.
Just like the maze.
That's right. It's just like the maze, isn't it?
So we're running around with the rubber bands, and you know, people were hiding in offices and stuff. And at one point, Greg was actually hiding in a closet, and we were kind of coming up on the closet.
And I did finally come out of the closet, yeah.
And I kind of threw open the closet and went, ah! And Greg had sort of a fight or flight reaction, and flight wasn't an option because his back was in the closet. So it was a quick kick to where it counted.
Oh, no.
And Howard was down for the count.
I don't remember that part of it.
I remember.
The other quick thing I might mention is Maze wasn't the only game we had developed. There was a sandwich shop we tended to go to a lot called Togo's, which was kind of in Los Altos or whatever. And this was right after the original round of kind of arcade Pong-like games. And they had one there called Drop Zone. And they had this contest going that if you get above a certain score, you get a free Togo sandwich. So one day we showed up with Don and Brian and Howard and a bunch of us with stopwatches and tape measures, and we basically wrote down everything about the game, went back to NASA, programmed the game on the IMLAC so we could practice enough to get good enough so we can come back and win some free Togo sandwiches. Unfortunately, by the time we got done with that whole effort and got good enough to come back, we went back and the machine wasn't there anymore.
Does the audience,
the
remaining audience, do they have, you guys have any maze stories?
Ah.
Aha, here we go. The mic is wandering.
My whole interest in this, when I was in high school, I was one of the urchins who snuck into MIT to use the computers and learn. There was no home computers in those days. And I remember many a late night playing Maze War. I didn't meet any of you guys because I was hiding. I didn't want to be caught up there. But I spent a lot of time on the machines. I wrote a 3D Space Wars game in 1986, and Maze War was my primary inspiration for it. I was going for the same level of excitement and interaction with the Space Wars game. So Maze War has done a lot to motivate a generation or two of game makers.
And your name is?
Ed Falk.
Ed Falk. Thank you, Zed. Anybody else out here? Maze stories? Want to write a new version? Okay.
Who came up with the classic maze design? You know that picture? Everyone always copies that. We, of course, added the capability to design your own and play with your own, but we always come back to that classic.
Yeah, the one that I had in my presentation, that came up.
I think it was the original, Steve's original maze, you know, when he first thought of it. I mean, a key part of it was to make the math simple enough. You had to assume you were at a fixed position. So to make the figuring out of what lines of the perspective easy to calculate, it was pretty much the same decision for each of the four corners at one block, and then the same for each block as you go down the maze, just scale. And the actual layout of the maze itself.
No, I meant the design. You have 16 by 32, but in the middle you have the long hallway and that little hidey holes.
Right. I think that was Steve's original layout that I think made it into the Ames version that I then took to the MIT version. I mean, we all added ways to change the maze. And of course, I added the cheat to be able to, on the fly, change the maze. But that was always the default one. And therefore, it tends to be the one that everybody played in, you know, without doing the extra work of loading your own maze.
Just mention that in my quest to not be disoriented all the time in the maze, I tried to use the maze editor to make one of a familiar location. So I took the MIT hallway map, the long corridor and the big anteroom areas, whatever it is. And it didn't actually work at all because the program actually assumed that you had no open areas. It was just corridors.
That's right.
And so you had these dummy walls between squares of open areas. It was kind of funny.
Yeah, I remember that because as you change the maze, if you end up having a larger width than one square, so if you knock out two empty ones that are next to each other, you get a zero width wall, as was the graphic algorithm. So it just looks like a real thin, just a wall board, effectively, that you could go down on either side.
Mr. Laird, I think we're going to...
Time to move to the exhibit.
We're going to retire. I invite you all to come up to the exhibit. We're kind of along the far wall, the maze pit, and we're actually going to unfurl the maze 30th birthday cake. If someone has a lighter, we need to light the candles, and then we're just going to do a little bit of video and cake cutting, and there's lots of plates and water, and it'll give you the afternoon sugar high you're all needing.
I should also mention, Ken, I haven't played the IMLAC version for I don't know how many years. Just today I went up, and I also could immediately know where I was because I remembered that original layout of the maze. And so, I can just from sitting down there, I could see, I knew where to get to the long hallway and the two sides.
It's incredible.
It's ingrained in a lot of people.
You can't remember your wedding anniversary date.
I remember that. My wife is here as well. I better remember that.
Well, I think this has been wonderful. And to the future generations that wondered where all this, how humanity got sucked into doing these games and in the 21st century, there'll be 100 million people in doing this. This because of the work of these guys here,
and many more too,
created the meme that is taking over the whole world, at least the wired world. And anyway, thank you.
And I want to thank Bruce for all his effort in bringing this together. I mean, if he really didn't kind of be the catalyst of making this happen, it wouldn't have happened. Thank you.
Thank you.